From the land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 30th day of October 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo, GlobalComResearch.com, out of Atchison, Kansas. Eric Snodgrass will join us to discuss the agricultural weather forecast. And along the way, I'll talk with Illinois Extension entomologist for field crops, Nick Sider, about beet and the potential to lose some of those products in the near future as it relates to some U.S. EPA comment periods that are currently underway. And that'll all happen right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
December corn today finished unchanged at $3.98.5. The March at 403.25, penny and 3/4 higher. July futures up 3 at 407.25, and December corn at 387.25, 3.5 higher. November beans up 4.75. Settlement price there at 1056.5. The January 1056.25, 5.75 cents higher, and the July futures at 1043.25, up 8.5 cents. November beans 971, 5.75 higher. The bean oil futures at 33.61.55 higher on the day. Meal up $1.70 at 378.60. Wheat futures, July contract, down a half at 592.5, and the hard red, a penny and a quarter higher, or rather lower for the day. Live cattle down 30 cents. Feeders were up $1.67.5, and lean hogs. We're now joined by Mike Zuzlo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. A beautiful day here. How about where you are?
It is a beautiful day out here, Todd. We're still coming off pretty cold temperatures. First real good hard freezes out here. And very, very dry wheat belt, though. New client in near Sedgwick County, which would be Wichita, and very close to the largest hard red wheat producing county in the whole state. Talk to me about the real significant problems brewing. So that 29% good to excellent in Kansas wheat is for real, and it's about twice as bad as it was last year at this time, and that matches up with the good to excellent being 55% last year. So we're looking at a really tough crop right now.
Yeah, so the wheat has been a supply-driven run. However, soybeans seem to be a demand driven function. What happened there this week?
Yeah, I think they're all coming together, and boy, do we need them to come together in terms of the supply and the demand side of the equation. But you're right, we did see the first monthly close in soybeans above 1045 since June of 2016. So we close out the month of October heading into the COVID spike, the U.S. election, and no stimulus. And those prices, those factors being price negative very much this week, for the whole commodity complex as well as stocks. We go into the next month and next week with a very strong underpinning because of the technicals, and also because of the fact that weather and La Nina in especially Argentina and southern Brazil are starting to get more and more traction. I would throw a note of caution out, Todd, at this point, though. Depending on how the election goes and COVID goes, it's really important to realize if you're a farmer or rancher right now that the longs in the commodity sphere that have been long because of reflation are probably only hanging on right now for the most part until they get past next week. And then we're going to have to go almost solely reliant upon the weather. So we're going to be back, I think, and I'm afraid to say we're going to be back to almost a completely weather-driven market if we don't get those macro factors back.
Yeah. So what happens in the middle of a weather driven market? I understand what happens, but what's the downside look like should the weather turn better?
Yeah, the volatility and the ability of producers and ranchers to move becomes a lot more constrained. You have a lot sharper rally when the weather is a factor. You have a lot sharper break to the downside when weather is a factor. In some cases, like 2011 and 2012, when we had that big high, which was a supply driven market, that gave us, I think, a 60 or 75 day rally. And I believe it was within 30 days, we had lost about 2/3 of the price peak and 2/3 of the total rally from low to high. You know, that roughly speaking, I don't have that right in front of me, but I think that's the key, is that these straight up and straight down markets are extremely hard to navigate. And then you throw on top of that the record issue with the COVID, the historical issue with the COVID, and also the U.S. election. So my take is that we really don't want to do anything in unlimited risk in the next couple weeks and maybe the next couple months. And to stay on the side of the sell and defend model is how I look at it.
We have been talking about filling the gap, meaning the delayed harvest gap in South America because of the delayed planting that has taken place. Do we have anything more going than that? Is there any demand outside of that in greater that's just larger than expected? Or once we fill the gap, do we, you know, find the floor come out from under us on that end of the spectrum as well?
It's a really good question because we really are at a situation, I think, where we've pulled a lot of demand forward, especially in the soybeans. We did see China reduce some soy meal demand in the weekly export sales. By the same token, we saw Brazil take on U.S. wheat. We saw them take on U.S. rice. We're not sure if they took on U.S. soybeans. It's unlikely based upon the GMO constraints that they face down there, but it could be happening. We have a scenario where the supply is still falling faster than the demand, and that feeds back into a positive feedback loop. In other words, if the weather still stays bad, the end users will still feel like they're not going to be able to get as much crop bought, and they're not going to get the food needs taken care of, and they're going to go out and buy even more into the future. And it's interesting you bring that question up because ADM did their quarterly earnings and conference call, and they spoke specifically about countries starting to become more aware of a food crisis again and a shortfall in food because the COVID reaction in the markets was good for commodity demand. It was good for commodity demand, not bad for commodity demand, except for the meatpacking industry.
Anything else before I let you go?
I think the big thing next week is the dollar a safe haven buy or not after the election, because that's what really finally kicked into gear. We had talked about that, and I'd been worried about that. We started to see a new monthly high in the dollar, new monthly low in crude. Does that continue after Tuesday?
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd. Have a great weekend.
You have a good Halloween. That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. I'm Todd Gleason, Illinois Extension field crops entomologist. Nick Sider now joins us to discuss some decisions that EPA, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, is planning to propose or may propose in the near future as it's related to BT corn. Nick, could you please lay out what EPA's proposals might look like?
So there's a few different measures that EPA is proposing, some that they are proposing now, and some that they are seeking public comment before they propose. So the measures that they're proposing now to deal with these, what they call non-high-dose pests, which are pests that we've had some resistance problems with already. You know, as far as the above-ground traits go, they've been extremely effective against European corn borer in particular and southwestern corn borer as well. But we have a few caterpillar pests that we haven't had the same degree of success with, pests that have done a little bit better job of overcoming those trait packages. And that's what they're looking at mitigating. So what they're proposing to do now, they're revising in some cases the way that they define resistance in these pests. A few of these procedures that they're changing will be more impactful to the industry, to the registrants than they are to growers. And that's going to deal with how they define practical resistance out in the field. They're going to define that based on damage levels observed in the field primarily, rather than just relying on resistance bioassays for these insects. They're also changing the way that they're reporting these incidents of what they call unexpected damage. So that's going to be more impactful to the industry. They're proposing a few things that will be relevant to growers, and that includes resistance monitoring using sentinel plots. So they're going to establish a network of sentinel plots that will be monitored continuously for resistance, particularly with corn earworm and with western bean cutworm. And, you know, then, of course, those notifications, if resistance is observed, will be distributed widely. They're also proposing that when resistance is observed in a commercial field, that a number of mitigation efforts will be taken to try and eliminate those populations. Now, these are what they are proposing currently. They also have a number of measures that they have proposed to propose, if you will. They've kind of taken the unusual step of floating some potential measures, taking public comment, and upon receiving that public comment, deciding whether or not they're going to pursue these. Now, one of these has to do with increased compliance monitoring for refuges. In the Midwestern United States, where we no longer have structured refuges, this won't be as much of an issue. In the Southern U.S., many of these varieties still require a separate structured refuge to be planted. And so they're looking at beefing up their compliance efforts with that, sort of beefing up the consequences if a farmer is non-compliant, as well as beefing up the record keeping to encourage seed dealers and farmers to work together to be compliant with that. The next measure that they are proposing to propose is increasing the percent refuge in our seed blend products. So currently, a refuge in a bag product with a pyramided BT hybrid is going to be a 5% refuge in a bag. They're proposing to increase that to 10% refuge in a bag nationwide for these above ground trait packages. And so that's something that could have some major implications for production and for pest management for our farmers. The big one, the one where probably the most controversy might be seen among farmers, is they're looking at phasing down trait packages that include either single traits or non-functional pyramids of these above-ground trait packages. Now, the consequence of that would ultimately be phasing down essentially any of these above-ground trait packages that do not include the VIP trait. That's what's, again, being proposed to be proposed, but they are seeking public comment on that currently to see how feasible that is. What we've seen in the past with these trait packages is that when a single trait is introduced, or when we have a pyramid that's compromised, so when we have a pyramid where one of the proteins the target insect has resistance to it, and you're only relying on a single protein at that point, that's an elevated risk of resistance. In fact, with several of these pests, with corn earworm, for instance, it's not an elevated risk so much as it's practically a guarantee that we're going to start seeing resistance. And that insect, especially in the southern United States, is driving a lot of this. With corn earworm, currently, we have some level of resistance out there to every trait that's available for its control, except for the VIP traits. But we're in a similar situation with the western bean cutworm. We just have that insect on a smaller amount of acres in more of a localized region, which is primarily the Western Plains and then the Great Lakes region of the Midwest. Tails into northern Illinois a little bit, but especially into northern Indiana, Michigan, and Ontario, they've had major issues with that insect pest. And similar to the corn earworm, they're down to one effective trait for that insect. Ultimately, what the EPA is trying to do here is to propose some measures to preserve those traits. They're simply deciding what the best way to go about doing that, to go about preserving those trait packages and those individual proteins is going to be.
Have you and your colleagues at other institutions talked about this or written letters to EPA on the subject?
We have talked about this extensively, and there are several groups that are in the process of producing some of these public comments, of producing letters to the EPA. So these measures are based on conversations the EPA had with a number of experts. They actually convened a panel on this issue back in 2018, and a number of my colleagues sat on that panel and provided recommendations. They've taken those recommendations combined with comments from industry and combined with their own data to produce these recommendations. And as you might imagine, in some cases, what they're proposing are exactly what my colleague suggested to them. In some other cases, there's a little bit of a difference there. And certainly the pest management community will provide their comments back to EPA on what they think is going to be the best course of action. And of course, we'll have to wait and see what ultimately results from this.
Is there a timeline EPA is working with?
I guess the short answer is after that public comment period closes, we don't really know how long we'll have to wait until we find out what the EPA will ultimately do. The phase downs that they're, again, proposing to propose are 3-year and 5-year phase downs of those products, depending on the individual products involved. So presumably they're looking at a relatively short turnaround time here. When we talk about that phase down period and some of these other mitigation methods, you know, several of us have made the point that in 3 to 5 years, we could be in a very different situation in terms of resistance with these insects. And very likely that situation is not going to be improved. We're likely to be in a worse situation in terms of resistance management by the time that comes along.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Nick Sider is an extension field crops entomologist at the University of Illinois. We've been discussing some proposals and potentially some proposals to propose that EPA is considering through the 9th day of November for comment period as it relates to BT corn and the potential to take some of those above ground traits off the marketplace. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On this Friday, we're joined by Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible to discuss the weather forecast. Happy Halloween to you. Looks like it's going to be a spooky and good one to me.
Yeah, unfortunately, it'll also be a windy one for us, too. I think Saturday is going to have just a pretty strong wind that's going to come out of the south for us at first and then switch as we go into Sunday and come more out of the west. And so, unfortunately, even though those temperatures are going to come back up for this weekend and early next week, we're going to have some windy conditions over the weekend.
Well, we'll get to what's happening in the future in just a second. But can you take me back over the last week? I think there were some interesting things happening in lots of places across the United States.
Yeah, so we had two major features, and one was a Hurricane Zeta, which means we have now tied the 2005 season for the most named tropical systems. And I just want to put this in perspective. In 2005, we had a Hurricane Zeta, but it happened in January of 2006. So it's actually lumped into the 2005 season, but that's how much earlier we got to the name Zeta this year. Well, Zeta came up, went very quickly from basically just east of New Orleans, and in one day exited through Virginia out through the mid-Atlantic. And it moved fast, produced a lot of very strong winds and some locally heavy rains. But it was the thing on the backside of it that was impressive. It's a cutoff flow. So by definition, it's a piece of the flow of the upper level of the atmosphere that's been cut off from the main jet stream. So you can almost think of it like like an oxbow on a river. You know, so the river cuts off this little piece that just sits like a little lake. Well, that's kind of what we had here. So it moves very slowly. And as it did so, we had major snow in the mountains out west. We had one of the most, I would call it an historic ice storm that went through parts of Oklahoma, putting down 1.5 to 2 inches of ice. And then that's the system that yesterday moved through parts of southern Illinois over in Indiana and Ohio, putting down a lot of precipitation. Now, we didn't get it here in central Illinois nearly as much as we did south and east. But those events this time of year can be extremely disruptive, and it certainly changed soil moisture a lot in the places that got the heavy rain and returned soil moisture to the southern plains, even though it did it via snow and ice. And so that's going to be a critical piece to watch as we move forward with the winter wheat crop.
What about the week two forecast?
So here's the thing. We've got this great week that's coming up, which we just talked about at the beginning, right? So we got drier conditions that are coming back in, and the temperatures are going to moderate. But I'm very concerned about seeing almost a repeat minus the hurricane. So here's what we see. Coming into the Pacific Northwest on like November 7th, about that time period, is another deep trough. And if it gets cut off over the Southwest, that's a slow-moving system across the midsection of the country. And if it moves just a little more north than the recent one, we could get more of that precipitation. So I start to think about fall field work, what our soil temperatures are going to be looking like, and the moisture coming in, and whether or not this setup, should it evolve, is going to be helpful for those things. So we've got something to be watching here as we go into the middle part of the first full week of November.
What does South America look like at this time?
Well, this has been interesting. In the Pacific, you and I have been talking for so long about how La Nina has been the developing factor. It's been the most dominant factor. But as of late, the Madden-Julian Oscillation, which kind of sits on top of that same region, well, it's kind of taken La Nina and pushed it into the backseat for a moment. So we have, over the next week, very heavy rainfall that's spreading through much of Brazil's northern and eastern growing areas. And it's going to be dry in southern Brazil and in Argentina. So I expect, and I talked to some folks down there, with the rain they're expecting to get, because of the timing, the time of day that it comes, they're going to get a lot of field progress done. We knew they were about, what, a quarter of the way planted last week at the beginning of this week. I'm expecting them to make some pretty rapid progress. But here's the number to think about. They're about 2.5 weeks behind. That's, I think, the general rule of thumb right now. 2.5 weeks is what the delay has been due to this extended drought time period. And therefore, we just need to build that into our thought process as we go throughout the rest of the season. So I think, though, that I'm going to be more concerned moving forward about southern Brazil and Argentina, as we've been talking about, as potential regions for drought development. But certainly this near term, it's going to be wet in Brazil.
About the Black Sea region, are they cooling down there?
Unfortunately, they're not. So when you look, it's pretty neat. If you looked at a map of the whole planet and tried to find the cold spots and the warm spots, North America right now is just tucked into this really cold air, especially in Canada, and it's going to come back again. What's interesting is, though, across Europe, we've actually allowed much of Eastern Europe, getting over toward the Black Sea region and the Russian wheat belt, to maintain some warmth. So despite the fact that they've had major drought in that area, precipitation amounts between 0 and 20% of normal over the last 60 days, you're going to be bringing in better chances at bringing in little bits of moisture. So we measure in millimeters over there. We're talking 15 to 30 millimeters. That's in half of an inch, maybe to 3/4 of an inch, or a little bit more. But it's not going to be everywhere, which means they're going to continue to see problems with the wheat belt in that part of Russia. That's just not enough rain to cure all the problems. But the only thing that's going to save them is it's not getting super cold anytime soon. If they had bitterly cold temperatures hit that area right now, it would be detrimental to that wheat crop, and we would really see a big reaction in the markets because of that.
Hey, you have a good Halloween. We'll talk with you again next week.
That sounds good. Thanks.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible.